KFI AM 640 live everywhere on the iHeartRadio app. Bill Handel here and the morning crew on a Thursday, December 1. We just got some numbers. Michelle just came in with new numbers on Postathon. And as of 7 o'clock, 6 minutes ago, we have raised for Katarina's Club, the charity that we adopted 12 years ago, $621,000. Actually, $621,306. So we're about $100,000 ahead of last year. And this is Katarina's Club, Feed the Kids. Bruno with Katarina's Club now feeds, 25,000 meals a week. He feeds those kids. I mean, it's an extraordinary, extraordinary effort he puts out. I mean, what a guy. And he's at the Anaheim White House. And who's you're going to be at the Anaheim White House?
No, I'm going to be at the Smart and Final in Capistrano Beach in Dana Point, 2 to 5 on Saturday. So what I'll be doing is call-ins during Neil Saavedra's show.
Okay.
And so we are taking your donations of money, at least, all the way through Sunday. But why don't you come by and see me and drop off your donation right there at Smart and Final.
Would be great. Now, as much as I so appreciate and love Smart and Final, I happen to shop there a lot, and their food is great. The food at the Anaheim White House is better. I have to be honest.
I might have to go with you.
Yeah. So when you drop off at the Anaheim White House, you'll literally have some of the best food you've ever had.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And they've got people out there 8 to 3 tomorrow. And well, today as well, but they're picking up your donations. So I know I've got rain coming in the forecast and I keep telling people, don't worry about it. You won't have to get out of your car. Just put the pasta and sauce in your trunk. Go to the Anaheim White House, pop your trunk, they'll get it out for you.
They'll get wet. Okay, moving over to what happened yesterday with the rail strike. The House passed the bill to avert the rail strike based on President Biden asking the House and the Senate to pass the bill that effectively stops the rail strike. Congress is allowed to intervene. The president's allowed to intervene. Congress is allowed to intervene under the Commerce Clause of the Constitution and the power. I would argue that in terms of governmental power, the Commerce Clause is by far the most powerful clause giving the government the right to do virtually anything relating to interstate commerce. And trains, yeah, that's all about interstate commerce. And this was about the economy crashing if the rails stopped running. We're talking about cargo, even the commuter, millions of people ride commuter trains to go to work? Now, what I found fascinating about this is the strange bedfellows. You had Republicans against this, and this is pro-business. You had the Chamber of Commerce, of course, in favor, saying, hey, we have to have business going on. Some Republicans are saying, no, don't want to get involved in the unions, and we don't want the government involved in the unions and the rails. Now, wait a minute. This is pro-business. Well, they just say the government shouldn't get involved. At the same time, Biden, who's the most pro-union guy on the planet, is saying, we're going to override what the unions are doing. All 12 unions will be forced to go to work. I think 8 already said yes, 4 said no. A deal was cut, I think it was last year or back, actually maybe in August of this year, where the unions agreed and then 4 said no and the whole thing fell apart and a strike is looming. And so Biden is being accused by his own people saying, what are you doing? Progressives, this is a union. How do you not back the union? As a matter of fact, in 1992, when there was a similar measure, there were 6 senators that were pro-union that didn't want the government involved. Biden was one of them. And so he's being accused of hypocrisy. How dare you do that? But here is the problem with that argument, hypocrisy, because here's Mr. Pro-Union. Here's the most pro-union president we've ever had. How about this? He's the president of the United States. He's not the president of the AFL-CIO. And, gee, you think the U.S. economy is more important than any kind of an altercation between the union and benefits that workers get? And not that that's not important. I get it. You work for the unions on the railroads. By the way, it's a great gig. I mean, that is a seriously good gig. You want to work for the unions. Sure beats asking passengers if they want to, you know, upscale the French fry order. Oh, believe me, much better job. But the point is, yeah, I understand. We understand if you're pro-union, but, you know, how do you let the economy collapse? And if there's any doubt, just think about all of a sudden chemicals stop being transported, food stops being transported, good cars being stopped transported. I mean, figure out what you buy, what you sell, and guess what? It's on a train. The transportations of goods and services based on commuters traveling on trains is, and the number of people that are directly employed and are would be affected, astronomical. So I don't think Biden has any choice. He did what he has to do. And it's too big a risk. Yeah, we're going to stop it. We're not going to let this we're not going to let the unions get involved. Not when the economy is so fragile. Actually, never, if they can't cut a deal. It's official as to Hakeem Jeffries. We knew this was going to happen. Who is Hakeem Jeffries? Okay, let's get it out of the way. The first black minority House leader. Okay, done. Thank you. Now, let's talk about the real story as far as I'm concerned. And that is how he got to be the Democratic leader. Why him? And it's really interesting, at least I think so. He was in the running, and the way it works when you go for the leader, if you win, by the way, if your party wins, you're the speaker, which is going to happen to Kevin McCarthy, which is why Nancy Pelosi, she's been the speaker for so long, because the Democrats have been in control. So if it turns out that the party leader is, the party's not in control, then that individual becomes the minority leader of the House. Makes sense. So let's compare him to the previous Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi, and this is what happens in many, many runs for speaker. It's an election. It's like you running for fourth grade class president. And of course, your campaign promises free pizza for everybody on Friday. This is a little bit more complicated, although he could probably pull off free pizza for everybody on Friday. I mean, he's going to have that much pull. So you run just, and you solicit votes and you politic. It's like running for pope. I know you Catholics go, no, this is a guy deciding who's going to be pope. No, it's not. You're politicking like crazy. You're selling yourself off and you're giving positions, et cetera, to people. And the run for minority leader or speaker is all politics. Now, Nancy Pelosi, she got it because, well, Nancy Pelosi is a machine in terms of raising money. That woman did, still can, raise unbelievable amounts of money. And her seat is totally safe, like Jeffrey's seats. Hakeem Jeffries' seat is so safe, I don't even know if he politics in his district. I mean, he's going to win. He's a six-term congressperson already. I mean, he's there as long as he wants to be. So you take that money and then you dish it out to other races. And that's how a party is controlled. The more money you can provide, the more powerful you are. And her thing was money. His thing is working with different groups together. He is Mr. Conciliation. He is Mr. Let's all work. Rodney King, can't we all be together, work together? Yes. That's what he's about. A little smarter, maybe, but that's what he's about. And so just look at what he was able to pull off in 2018. And that was the First Step Act. And what was that? That was a bill that was passed by Republicans, by Democrats, during the Trump administration, where everybody got together. And it basically reformed our prison system. And it set up different kinds of sentencing, and the point is to decrease recidivism. So the important part of this is he put it together. He was the lead sponsor. By the way, that bill was the most significant criminal justice reform to pass Congress in years. So how did he do it? Well, he got together a wide spectrum of Democrats, the Trump administration, Republicans. And he was able to put it off, and he got the credit for it. This is what this guy does. He is able to work with every member of Congress on all sides and the administration. Now, he's a pretty liberal guy, not a progressive. even though he's sometimes he talks about being progressive and sometimes he describes himself, sometimes others do, don't. I mean, basically, he is a moderate sort of liberal. I mean, he's not crazy. And to the point where you got the real progressives, the real liberals, Elizabeth Warren's of the world, the AOCs of the world, really coming down on him, saying, you're not going far enough. You're not going far enough. And his position is, we've got to work together and because we have no choice. And that is how he puts bills together. We're talking, and this point, we know this, and that is, it is probably the most polarized Congress, certainly that I can remember, and I've been voting a long time. Everything goes down party lines, everything. You have Republicans that vote no just because Democrats vote yes, or the administration is pushing for something, notwithstanding the validity of anything that's happening. Same thing on the other side. A Republican measure is introduced, goes down party lines. Republicans vote yes, Democrats vote no. I mean, it has become that nuts. Automatically, it's if President Biden comes out and says A, before he finishes A, the Republican leadership says B. Mitch McConnell stands up and goes, oh, no, we can't have that. Let's have a vote, party lines. And here is a guy, Jeffries, who does it in a totally different way. He goes, and he has the credibility. It's not just Rodney King, can't we all get along? It's not lip service. He does it. And the way he does it and his power, which he's going to have plenty of, is because he is trusted by basically everybody. He says what he means and means what he says. And he's got creds. He does have creds. And it was just a month ago that he officially launched his bid for minority leader and was able to put the votes together where he became the obvious leader of the party, much like Kevin McCarthy, who even though there is a struggle or was a struggle, there's no issue. He's got it. He's going to become the Speaker of the House. And then the issue becomes, are they going to be able to work together? I will tell you that I believe that Jeffries is much more apt to work in conjunction and to compromise and to try to work together than Kevin McCarthy is. I believe Kevin McCarthy is much more an ideologue who is and the speaker has unbelievable power is to tell his party, this is the way you're going to vote. A speaker can decide not to bring a bill on the floor. That's how much power a speaker has. It goes through a hearing process. It goes through the committee. And if the speaker doesn't like the bill, he or she simply says, not going to vote. Same thing with Mitch McConnell as when he was majority leader of the Senate and Chuck Schumer. Who now is the majority leader, equivalent to the speaker. So Hakeem Jeffries, we're going to be hearing an awful lot about him, and he's tall, too. And he and thin. And very, very smart. He has a reputation of being whip smart. We're going to be paying more for energy. We know that. Natural gas prices are going to be more expensive, but natural gas is a whole world onto itself. It's very different stuff than, for example, the price of oil. We start with the fact that the largest natural gas producer and the largest natural gas reserves on the planet is the United States by a long shot. And over the past few years, have you ever noticed how cheap your gas bill is relative to your electricity or your water bill? I mean, it's a fraction of your energy bill, your total energy bill. Why is that? Because there's a glut of natural gas out there, and it has been for years. Matter of fact, a lot of gas companies just like went out of business, especially if they didn't have other energy sources they were able to sell. Utilities, for example. And so there's this huge glut of natural gas. And all of a sudden, there isn't, for a couple of reasons. First of all, Russia. Russia's the big one. Ukraine, because when you go over to that part of the world, the largest producer of natural gas is Russia. And this is where Europe is just, Europe is in trouble when it comes to natural gas, big time. Because they get their gas from the Soviet Union. And there's a pipeline that goes from the Soviet Union to supply Europe. And when it was being built, the United States was screaming at Germany, which was the biggest proponent. I mean, screaming at Germany, do not let this happen. And Germany told us to go pound sand. Hey, how did that work out, huh? So Europe is scrambling to try to get natural gas. And the way natural gas is transported, it's in liquid form. They take the gas we have in our pipes and they condense it. And under great pressure, it turns into liquid, LNG. And then it's put on these huge container ships. I mean, they look like oil ships, you know, the ones that are like 3,000 feet long. And I mean, it's pipes all on the top. I mean, it's crazy. I don't know how many zillions of gallons of liquid natural gas they deliver, but a whole lot of them. And those are coming from the United States because we have all the natural gas in the world. And then Obama passed a law or signed a law that allowed natural gas to be sold to Europe at less cost than it is here because it's regulated. In other words, Europe's going to pay less for natural gas than we are, which means that all of a sudden the market explodes around the world for our gas. And since it is, they're allowed to sell it for less, we are buying it for more. And all of a sudden the market has turned around. First of all, a lot of it is now being sold and they're building terminals to not only produce the natural gas, but also terminals to pipe it onto these massive ships, which also take years to build. And all of a sudden, the entire natural gas market globally is completely disrupted. And the things that matter in terms of the price of natural gas is, first of all, supply. Russia. Man, has that screwed up everything because of the war in Ukraine. Also, just how hot it is. How cold is the winter going to be? And it's, for example, the same thing as energy. During the summer, the hotter it is, the more energy you use for AC. Same thing in winter, the colder it is, the more natural gas you use. Also, natural gas powers the power plants here in Southern California. A lot of them are coal, and they're moving away from them in the east. The furnaces over there in that part of the country burn oil. We burn natural gas, which is a much better deal for us, even though the prices are rising. So you have the temperature outside, cold, warm. You have Russia, and also the way they charge. It's regulated, and they're able to charge in a different way where it makes sense. So how do they measure the price of natural gas? What is the measurement? What is the metric? It's called the Henry Hub. What? Yeah, it's called the Henry Hub. And that is the wholesale price of natural gas named after a distribution spot in Louisiana. Here's a fun factoid for you. You've heard of Brent crude oil? Brent crude is the yardstick by which oil is looked at, sold all over the world. When you see the price of oil, that it's, and that's what's given to us, and that's what is promoted, and that's what we see in all the news outlets, and this is around the world, too. Whatever it is, the price of a barrel of oil is in Brent oil, which is the sweetest, the easiest oil to crack, as it were, to make gasoline, kerosene, other products. And so where does the word Brent's oil come from? After Brent's Deli? I would say that, but it's not. Brent's oil is named after a bird. Actually, the Brent Goose. And it derived from a group of companies, one company specifically, that explores. And what it does is look for oil for a group of oil companies, the big oil companies. They hire these companies. And this one company, in fact, had an oil field in Louisiana, and they named their oil fields after birds. And this became, after the Brent goose became Brent oil. You're going to ask that on Jeopardy, you're going to win, huh? So you've got the Henry Hub for natural gas. You have Brent crude for oil. And we're paying a lot more. Why? Because there's no longer a glut, because Europe and the rest of the world is buying, which is great. Great news for us. Big investment, takes a while, regulated, can sell it overseas, put it all together, and what do you have? Well, look at your gas bill. But keep in mind, natural gas is still by far the cheapest way to produce energy in the United States. I mean, it's probably cheaper in Iceland where it's all geothermic. But I tell you, we're actually pretty lucky here in terms of the cost of gas, natural gas. The only thing is we have the fossil fuels issue because we have to be emissions neutral by, what, 2035, 2040. So that's an entirely different story. I have talked many times about the internet, and the internet is, well, it's something that was introduced to a lot of us. We were there in its infancy, never heard of it, and all of a sudden it became a thing. And when you talk about a thing, history is going to look at the internet in the same light as man's use of fire, the invention of, or the use of the wheel, the invention of the printing press. I mean, we're talking big, big stuff. The internet is right there. And it may very well be the most important thing that ever happened to mankind, because anybody can know everything or have access to everything on the planet. Well, there's ups, there's downs. We've talked about that. And there is something called internet sleuthing, in which people just love to get into cases and try to solve them. People by the millions. If you look at the world of podcasts, the number one type of podcast out there, the most popular are true crime podcasts. People are fascinated with crime. How many television shows out there are about true crime? I like them. I know very few people that don't. Well, part and parcel of that, it's not just the podcasting, it's not just the television shows, it's also what happens on the internet where people are sleuthing. Let's get together, we're all amateurs, and we can play detective. Now, occasionally it does happen where internet sleuthing does come into place. Gabby Petito, the 22-year-old New Yorker, remember, she went missing last year. And she documented her cross-country travels on social media with her fiancé, and people dived into it, and it helped the police figure out what was going on. Yeah, but that's an outlier. That's one in thousands. What happens with these big profile cases is that the internet gets involved. And right now, the University of Idaho, you know, a vigil was held last night in remembrance of the four students who were fatally stabbed in the off-campus home. No suspect at this point, no motive, and is 2 weeks out. Hundreds of tips and calls provided to local, state, federal investigators as a result of the cyber sleuthing. And the police take them all seriously. And you've got people all over the world that are looking at what's on the internet, things that are leaked, suppositions, photos of or videotape of what the police release, and there's the, you know, and some of them are so grainy you really don't even recognize them, but all of a sudden the sleuths go into it and they start naming people that may have some connection. There was a couple of cases where just the wrong person was named, and imagine this: your name is out there. And you are being either accused of the crime outright, or the world is being told, you know, this guy Bill, was walking near there, and let's try to connect him. Well, it looks like he went to school with someone that this family knew, the brother, and all of a sudden start connecting the dots. If there are any dots, or dots become manufactured, and now we have a suspect. Now we have a lead. And then the police are told about it. And again, the police, they follow every lead. Unless, you know, Elvis had a kid with a Martian And there he is. Oh, which, by the way, that would probably be followed up, too. There are people who have seen Elvis's and the Martian's kid. There they are. But, you know, that's almost not an exaggeration because there's so much crazy stuff out there. And it's getting bigger and bigger. And here's what the police are saying, that occasionally, very occasionally, this will help. But in the vast, vast majority of cases, what it does is simply convolute the entire case. Too much information comes in, which really has no connection. Jennifer, I mean, you do the news. How much of the news and over the years are you looking at that's coming in on the internet or people email you and start putting the pieces together because all of a sudden they have knowledge?
It doesn't happen that often, but
that
you
doesn't
can,
help me.
Well, no, but
you were supposed to say a lot.
Hold on. But what I was going to say is when it does, usually I can follow up on it. Now, what I'm saying is the tips don't come in that often, but when they do, they are credible.
Okay, so I asked the wrong person. Thank you. You won't be answering questions again. But
happens all the time for me, Bill.
Yeah, there you
all
are.
All the time.
All right, but for example, there's one Facebook group, right, that does this. Users dissect past social media posts to figure out what's going on. What friends did you have before you died if you're a victim? Let's piece together interactions with other people on Instagram, what hints are coming out of, or look at Facebook, look at Venmo accounts, and just try to put it all together because you are a sleuth. Well, one private Facebook group has 32,700 members, just this little tiny group. There is a forum on Reddit, 27,000 members, where the users, they post theories and they analyze statements, what people have said. I mean, even to the point where things that are, you know, they somehow get hold of an essay that someone wrote 20 years ago in school. TikTok, you look at the hashtag Idaho murders, there's 94 million views. And the questioning is, the user's question, if a serial killer is behind the deaths, or if the homicides are linked to other cases or maybe unsolved stabbings in the region. You talked about that this morning, Jennifer, where 10 miles away there was another stabbing.
Yep.
And let's put those pieces together. You don't think the police are already doing that?
I have a feeling.
Yeah. And so the police in Moscow right now, Moscow, Idaho, are going, what the hell's going on? They're inundated with this stuff. And the cops are saying, you know, you got to leave us alone with this. And one of the police officers said in a news outlet person, he's a spokesperson for the police, said there's speculation, no factual backing, stoking community fears, spreading false facts. And this is what we're being dealt. And there's no controls. You can say almost anything. You can say anything to the police. You can point to someone and say, look at him. He did it on the internet. I mean, a straight out accusation. You try doing that in person to a cop. If I'm, for example, I come up to a police officer in Moscow and I go, hey, I know who did it. And it is Jennifer.
Why me?
Because you answered the question incorrectly a little while ago, and you didn't help me out on that. You went the wrong way.
Now I'm a murder suspect.
That's precisely it. You're now a murder suspect. And now if I did it on the internet, I'm untouched. If I do it to a cop in person, all of a sudden you go, wait a minute. How about filing a false police report? The point is what the internet does is allow anybody to say anything at any time.
Yeah.
And it is, we're just starting to understand what it does. One of the things that I have said over and over again is we really don't know where all this is going. A few years ago, I used to talk about Corey Hong, who is one of the great internet visionaries. I mean, he started very early on and has huge contracts with the CIA and all kinds of governmental entities and huge businesses. And I asked him, you know, Corey, you've been in this from the very beginning. Where do you think it's going to go? And he said, I have no idea, but whatever it is beyond your imagination. You can't even think of where this is going to go. And we've got our business news segment, and we have a little bit to talk about here. Just a touch is what's going on. All right, the rail strike is effectively over. Nancy Pelosi said that it would be disastrous, catastrophic is the word she used, if this thing had gone forward. And it's interesting that Republicans are with the unions saying the government shouldn't be involved. I mean, that is crazy.
It is.
But let's talk about how critical the rail is to our economy.
Oh, it's look, the U.S. economy is 66% consumer driven. Well, how do those consumer goods get where they're going? I mean, how do they get to the shelves? A lot of it, most of it, majority of it is by rail. So there's that too. I do think that, yeah, you're right. In this polarized environment, it's kind of interesting to see the bedfellows here. But there is the one sticking point that I saw, at least from the far left faction of the Democratic Party, was the sick leave issue that was not settled. But this was brokered by the Biden administration 6 weeks ago, and it was right before the election and looked like it was going to stick. And so I think you mentioned earlier on your show, 8 out of the 12 unions said okay to it, and then there were 4 that kind of held back, and Congress had to step in and do it, because otherwise it is a screeching halt. Like, you've heard the rails hit the brakes. It would have been like that.
Okay, so with that, I'm thinking in terms of what industries would be the most disastrous, if you want to put it in there. I know the most important one that affected Americans the most deeply in since the founding of this country was the baseball strike. I mean, that just destroyed so many people. Yeah, that was a tough one.
A little too soon, Bill.
Okay.
A little too soon.
Yeah. But if you're talking about, let's say the airline industry is shut down.
Sure.
And that's going to be a huge hit. Doesn't compare to the rails, does it?
No, not really. I mean, shipping is the only thing that comes to mind, and that's an international thing. So you're going to have less labor dispute there. You're going to have less labor negotiation and contracting issues around that, because when the ships come in, they have to go someplace, and they usually go to the rails. I mean, that's what those cargo containers do, or on the backs of trucks.
And and the trucks, I mean, we are going obviously to the trucking industry in terms of cleaning it up. And I mean, there's all kinds of laws that are going to affect that it has to be. And matter of fact, it's the trucks that go to the ports that are being first electrified.
That's right.
And I mean, I don't even know how they're going to afford those prices. I mean, I just don't get it. But the point is that without rails, then it. The domino effect, and that's going to affect shipping, and that's going to affect manufacturing, and that's going to, I mean, that's one of the real, I guess, the real gridlock points that can wipe out an economy.
Sure. All the tributaries you just mentioned lead to the Mississippi of the economy, and that is inflation. So this would have slowed things down, and the availability of goods would have driven the market way high, and then inflation would have gone up even more. And I think that is a top line, 2-inch headline number that a lot of voters care about as well.
All right, let's move over to number one, consumers keeping the economy afloat, and the jobs market. Did we just hear U.S. Companies added 127,000 jobs in November? What does that mean? Because at 300,000, 200,000, people don't really know what that means.
Well, the target by the Fed, right? So the target has two goals, right? That is interest rates and full employment, and interest rates slash inflation. So for their number, the Fed's number targeted is 200,000 jobs a month. So we got 127,000 reported by ADP, which is a private payroll company, which is usually pretty accurate, frankly. We get the official government number tomorrow morning in around 24 hours. So yeah, 127. So the thing to watch there is, I think at the end of the year in Q4 right now, you usually see companies that have fiscal calendars that align with our regular calendar, January through December, want a gap. They have to plan for their next economic year. And so they try to fill jobs. Doesn't look like that's really happening right now. So 127,000 coming down. Now, an economist will tell you that the labor market is a lagging indicator of how the economy is doing. And we've been talking for weeks, Bill, about a possible recession for next year. And the Labor Department definitely comes in with this number. So we'll have the official number tomorrow, but this one, and we can talk a little bit about spending soon. Right now, the Dow is down 315 points. The S&P is basically flat. The NASDAQ is a little bit up. but just a little bit. And that's because it's coming off of a historic bottom. So a little bit of recovery before the end of the year kind of makes sense. Now, we usually see a Santa Claus, what they call a Santa Claus rally, that'll start around a couple days before Christmas and take us through the end of the year as people reposition money and move things around on the markets. That's not necessarily indicative of what's happening in the market overall. I think what you were referencing there is the possibility for a recession next year. Now, we are technically in a bear market right now and have been for a while.
Right, right. Bear market means a market that is going down, a market
It's tightening, yes, for sure. And so there are certain sectors of the 13 available sectors in the U.S. economy, there are some that are seeing a little bit of a spike here and there, but that's a lot of people putting money into safe havens kind of things and coming out of things like tech.
Let me ask, in terms of the word recession and a bear market— the number comes up in that, two quarters of negative growth.
Right.
Is that just a number where if you're just short of that number, you're not in recession?
Man, 3 years ago, it would have definitely been the working definition and the definition of what a recession is. But we've been having such a weird economy since the pandemic started that it's been tough to track. Like we've talked about the jobs market coming in. That's a lagging indicator. They're not hiring as much as they were earlier this year, but consumers are still spending. Inflation's at 7.7%, and 2/3 of the economy is spending, and 20% of the annual economy of the United States happens right now during the holiday season.
Yeah, one of the things that I looked at, I looked at Cyber Monday and what was happening on Black Friday, is that all the numbers that the economists told us were blown away in terms of sales. They didn't anticipate the big sales coming in.
Right.
What does that say?
Well, I think that part of that has to do with, I think there's two angles to this one. The pricing, first of all, we've been dealing with an inflationary system where the prices coming into the discounts that we're getting right now kind of are not as discounted as they would have been 6 months ago, 8 months ago, 9 months ago. The other thing is a lot of people are doing buy now, pay later. And a lot of that's going on to credit cards, which is an increasing rate as well as the Fed continues to raise rates. I think I'll ballpark it. Anecdotally speaking, buy now, pay later is up 75% year on year from last year.
Now, what's the difference between buy now, pay later and simply putting it on a credit card, which strangely enough is buy now, pay later?
Well, it is that. But when you're checking out online, often when you're in your cart and you can just click like pay full now or just hit this button, it goes over there. And it's usually a lower bit of a rate because it's pegged. You're pegged to 3 or 4 months to pay back everything in installments.
All right. So it's not basically forever paying minimum payments.
Yeah, it's
payments.
Not rolling over a capital every month and building on that on the interest.
All right. I'd mentioned that the trucking is they're going electric. And is that the ports where it is starting, where the ports have to be all electric in terms of delivery trucks?
Right.
And Tesla has an event today, and I started questioning you about the trucks themselves. So I know it's in Las Vegas, right?
Yes, that's right. Okay. It's in Nevada. Giga Nevada is the name of the complex.
Okay, so tell us what's going on there.
Well, 5 years ago, 2017, you might remember Elon Musk standing on stage with a big, beautiful semi that looks like a space age, kind of like almost like, you know, like the Endeavor or whatever, like a space shuttle, basically. He promised 500 miles on a charge. He didn't necessarily mention how much payload would be involved with that 500. So having said that, today they are rolling them out. Pepsi is the first company that's going to get these 300 to 500 miles range for the electrics. Renault and Mercedes also have ones rolling out very soon, too, within weeks, really. And the Renault is apparently a little bit lighter and can go a little bit farther. But even at 500 miles, we were talking about this too, from LA to San Francisco is about 350, depending on where you are. If you have a full load of something that has to go back and forth, I mean, that's a long recharge time as well.
Do you know what kind of truck it is that he's rolling out? Is it equivalent to an 18-wheeler?
Yeah, it is.
Okay, so we're talking long haul.
Yeah, well, supposedly, I mean, they're built for long hauls, but the battery charge is 300 to 500 mile range.
And that's my question, because I was just looking this up. How far does the average long haul truck go on a tank of gas? And of course, it depends on how big the tank is. But consider they go anywhere from 6 to 9 miles per gallon. You can have it's not unusual to have a 100, 200 gallon tank, 300 gallon tank, and you're talking 2,000 miles.
Right.
So going to a charging station and spending, well, a car is 20 minutes for a fast charger. I'm assuming that a long haul trailer, a tractor trailer, will be a lot more than that. That just screws everything up. Where's the market here other than short haul delivery? I mean, your Frito-Lay truck delivering to the supermarket, that I can see.
Well, efficiency is going to be built into this. So I think the recharging aspect, the conundrum that you mentioned, I think that's probably going to be diminished over the coming years as things roll into the market, new technologies emerge, that kind of thing. The other thing is, too, there's a risk reward. So having something delivered by an electric vehicle like this, as opposed to a gasoline-driven vehicle, might be something that consumers, you know, care about because of the emissions that are involved in long-haul trucking. Now, the price tags seem to be relatively similar, $180,000 for these Teslas that are coming out. The Inflation Reduction Act that passed over the summer provides a $40,000 tax break if you buy these. And if you're buying fleets of trucks, That's a lot of money.
Yeah, it is. I love the $180,000, which I don't know if it's going to be, because I've been looking for an electric, so I've been looking at all of them. And Tesla, there's the Y and the X SUV.
Right.
And the X, which was the first one that came out, is $145,000.
Dude, just get a semi.
What is that about?
Look,
what?
Just get a semi. You're going to get a 40 grand off of that anyway. So it's 140. So 180 minus 40, and you got a semi.
We're right there. I mean,
talk about a side hustle.
Yeah, that was, and I mean, that's kind of nuts. It really was.
It kind of is.
All right, and then just real quick, we finish up, and this is a very local story that's also international. Disney, which is just down the street. We can walk to Disney
from
here.
I'm looking at the parking lot.
Bob Iger came back. What does that mean?
It means he has job security for as long as Bob Iger takes breath.
He was the CEO. He left. I'm assuming he left voluntarily, right?
Yes, he did.
He retired. And now, and then his successor was chosen by him, right?
That's correct.
And now that didn't work. So now he's back.
Now he's back. And he's got 2 years coming back. So, and part of the mandatory things that he has to do other than make, you know, streaming profitable, however that's going to happen. Also, he has to name his successor in conjunction with the board because they don't want to go through this again. So if he can't find somebody that the board likes, now Bob's 71 years old and very fit, so he could probably do this for a while longer than 2 years if he wants to. So if you don't find a successor, even though that's kind of your gig, it sounds like you might have a salary for a while.
Yeah. Oh, and just a little factoid. When Walt Disney set up his distribution company in the 20s, and his offices and were right there. It's called the Buena Vista Distribution Company. You look at all the Disney films, say, and why? Where do they get Buena Vista? Because it's on Buena Vista Boulevard.
Beautiful.
It's right there.
It is a Buena Vista as well.
Yes. Oh, there you are. All right, Jason, thank you. We will always talk again. Have a good one.
Thanks, Bill.
This is KFI AM 640 Live everywhere on the iHeartRadio app.